Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We have an interesting show for you this morning. Our first guest is Bruce Jakowski, a MAVEN principal investigator from the University of Colorado at Boulder. MAVEN, well, it's another acronym, M-A-V-E-N, stands for the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. The MAVEN spacecraft launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida on November 18, 2013, and a couple Sundays ago, after a 442-million-mile journey, it slid into the Mars orbit. It's the first spacecraft dedicated to exploring the upper atmosphere of Mars. Bruce is going to tell us about the significance of the upcoming experiments.
Good morning, John. It's so exciting. It'll be really great to hear about MAVEN. Our second guest this morning is Michael Harris. In his new book, The End of Absence, Harris argues that amid all the changes we're experiencing, the most interesting is the one that future generations will find really hardest to grasp. That is the end of absence, the loss of lack. The daydreaming silences in our lives are filled, the burning solitudes are extinguished. There's no true free time, at least not when you carry a smartphone. Today's rarest commodity is the chance to be alone with your thoughts. An interesting conversation with Michael Harris.
As it turns out, daydreaming is pretty important, huh, Lynn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. Good thing, because we do a lot of it.
We do. These two guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest is Bruce Jakowski, MAVEN principal investigator from the University of Colorado. MAVEN, an acronym for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. Well, the spacecraft has just completed a 10-month, 442-million-mile journey to Mars. It's now orbiting the planet. MAVEN will begin a 6-week commissioning phase that includes testing all the instruments and science mapping sequences. After that, MAVEN will begin its one Earth year primary mission, which is taking measurements of Mars' upper atmosphere. Bruce Jakowski, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, this is an exciting project, Bruce. And how long have you been involved in this?
We started planning just about 11 years ago, but most of the work really took place over the last 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. Sending a spacecraft to Mars is not an easy thing or something that you just do on the spur of the moment. It requires a lot of advanced planning.
Absolutely. And you had Goddard Space and you had Lockheed. I mean, there's a lot of different moving pieces to this, a lot of different, a lot of coordination, I would expect.
Absolutely. We put together a team that was able to do this, drawing from the most experienced, best groups around the country and including some international participation. So we had Lockheed Martin in Colorado build the spacecraft. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center is managing it for us, the whole effort. And science instruments and science team from my institution, University of Colorado in Boulder, from University of California, Berkeley, and from Goddard Space Flight Center.
Right. Bruce, if you could take a moment and just describe for us the spacecraft and the instrumentation payload.
The spacecraft is an orbiting spacecraft. Since we're trying to look at the upper atmosphere, we're taking the measurements from the best place possible, and that is in the upper atmosphere. We're making measurements, we will be making measurements at altitudes where we can sense the atmosphere directly, even though it's really pretty thin. The spacecraft itself is roughly a cube about 7 feet on a side with solar panels extending out from it. End to end with the solar panels extended, it's about the length of a school bus, 37 feet. And the total weight of the spacecraft when we launched it, including fuel, was about the same as a large SUV, the same weight as a GMC Yukon fully fueled up and with all of its cargo.
Wow.
We have 8 science instruments designed to measure the energy input from the sun, the response of the upper atmosphere to that energy, and how much stuff is escaping at the present time. We're trying to understand the processes that control the escape, that control the upper atmosphere, and learn enough that we can determine how much gas has escaped space over geological history. That's the real goal of the MAVEN mission.
Huh, interesting. So as John said in his intro, MAVEN has been traveling all these 442 million miles to get to the orbit of Mars. Now, when it crossed over into Mars orbit a couple weeks ago, what were the final stages that, you know, what finally propelled it over the, you know, the border, shall we say, into Mars orbit?
When we launched from Earth, we put it on an orbit, into an orbit around the sun, and when it gets out to Mars' location in the solar system, we time the launch so that Mars is there. So as we're approaching Mars 2 Sundays ago on the 21st, as we're approaching it, we're coming in at a speed of a little over 3 kilometers per second. And if we don't do anything, we fall down Mars' gravitational well and just whip on right by it and back into space. So we needed to slow down. We did that by firing our rocket engines on board to change our velocity by a little over a kilometer per second, and that was enough to put us into orbit. We targeted a very elliptical long-period orbit because that gave us the most safety, the most chance of successfully getting into orbit. But we don't want to do our science measurements from that orbit. We need a closer in orbit. We're doing now a series of maneuvers where we fire the rocket motors to change our orbit. In the end, we have about 7 maneuvers we need to do to get to our science mapping orbit. And as of today, we've carried out 2 of those.
Wow.
So we're in the middle of adjusting the orbit.
Oh, that's so interesting. So no doubt you rehearsed this somehow many, many times. Tell us a little bit about the rehearsals. I mean, so that you knew with any certainty that you could fire those rockets and keep some consistency in the orbit.
That's actually a really good question, and it's very important because we need to test everything. The last thing you want to do is to carry out something on the spacecraft that it hasn't done before. So we tested the maneuvers on the ground before we launched it. We actually ran the spacecraft through all of its paces, and it thought it was going into orbit, and it thought it was firing its engines. We made sure those would work. In addition, we have what I'll call a duplicate spacecraft in the lab here on Earth. It's the exact same components, and we test everything on that before we send the commands up to the spacecraft. That also gives us the chance to throw anomalies at it. We can be running the sequence and then tell it all of a sudden there's a problem with the computer and see how it responds. The spacecraft is far enough away when it goes into orbit that we don't have time to react to any problems it has. It has to solve them on its own. It has to identify the problem and solve it entirely on its own. Then the last thing we did was we actually rehearsed it with the team, and we did several rehearsals of going through the orbit insertion sequence to make sure the team knew what to do. And again, there, we had a group in the back room throwing problems at us. So we had to deal with problems. We had to deal with last-minute emergency maneuvers in practice so that we knew how to do it and had our processes and our procedures in place in case we had to do that. The amazing thing is we didn't have to do any of that. There were no problems on the spacecraft. There were no problems in tracking. Everything just went incredibly smoothly, and we just went right into orbit. To give you an idea of how perfect the orbit was we went into, we were targeting a period of 35.0 hours. That's how long it would take to do one orbit around Mars. And we could tolerate anything that was maybe 5 or 6 hours different from that.
Yeah.
The actual orbit we went into had a period of 35.02 hours.
Oh, that's so precise.
It's amazingly close. It looked like a rehearsal.
Yeah.
Bruce, the surface, the Martian surface, shows huge, huge, vast dry lakes and riverbeds. And that's what it appears to be, as if there used to be water on the surface. Your instrumentation has something to do with trying to figure out if there was water, what happened to it. Is that correct?
That's exactly what the driver is. From measurements that all of the recent spacecraft over the last 20 or 25 years, really all the Mars spacecraft that we've sent there have shown us, we know that there are features that look water-carved, and there are minerals that form only in the presence of water. Yet, water isn't stable on Mars today. What we want to do is answer the question of where did the water go, assuming that the water was made stable by a greenhouse atmosphere to warm the temperatures. Where did the CO2 go that produced that greenhouse? There are two places it can go. It can either go down into the crust and get locked up as minerals, or it can go to the top of the atmosphere and be lost to space. So far, we haven't identified enough minerals locked up in the crust that it could be a repository for the ancient CO2. And in fact, there are reasons we think that a significant amount may have been lost to space. So what we're trying to do is to understand how much gas may have been lost to space over the last 4 billion years and how much that loss contributed to the change in Mars climate. This mission really is about climate change on Mars and understanding the processes responsible for it.
How much really can, you know, when you find out about how the gases escaped and where the water went on Mars, what does that tell us and how do we apply it back here on Earth? Or is it even connected, really? Is it just unlocking some more mysteries about Mars itself?
I can connect it back to Earth, but let me start with the broader question. One of the things we're interested in today, one of the real driving philosophical question is whether there's life elsewhere, whether we're the only life in the solar system or in the universe. For Mars, with it having had liquid water in the past, we really want to understand whether there could have been life and what processes controlled the ability of Mars to support life. So what we're learning about is the habitability of Mars by microbes. What affects the habitability? What changes it over time? More generally, then, we're learning about what controls the habitability of a planet. With all the planets being discovered around other stars, we're interested in which ones could be habitable, how many could be habitable, and what controls the ability of a planet to support life. So I see that as the broader question. If we try to bring it back to Earth, it's not as directly applicable, and the main reason is that Earth has a magnetic field that keeps a lot of the processes operating at Mars from operating at Earth. We think that a lot of the gas may have been stripped off by the solar wind at Mars, but the magnetic field on Earth keeps the solar wind from removing our gas. However, we can understand how individual processes work, and by understanding how they work on Mars, how the solar wind interacts with the upper atmosphere, how the chemical processes work on Mars, we're seeing them in a different environment on Earth, and that lets us understand how they work on Earth better because we can understand the basic physics and chemistry better.
Bruce, I recently viewed a picture, an oblique of Mars from the Mars orbital mission that I believe is also has just gone into orbit. That's the Indian spacecraft, and it showed the atmosphere as ribbon thin. How thin is the atmosphere compared to our atmosphere here?
Today, the atmosphere is a little bit less than 1% as thick as the Earth's atmosphere, and it's mostly carbon dioxide. despite that, we think it was thicker in the past. It's a very thin, tenuous atmosphere today, but still thick enough to have weather, still thick enough to have clouds, to support dust storms, things that we're familiar with here on Earth. So we see it as very much an Earth-like planet, maybe not exactly today, but a good parallel.
Right. Very interesting. And, you know, I know we have somewhere in southern Utah this Mars simulation outpost. And it is interesting when you see the photos of Mars. It does look a lot like southern Utah in many places.
Bruce,
one of the really exciting questions is whether we can send people to Mars. And an outpost like that are an opportunity to test out some of the thoughts of how we might do that, of how people could survive on a several-year-long trip to Mars.
Hmm. Yeah, Bruce, India just put MOM up, which is a Mars orbital mission, which I believe is just for observing the planet. And they boast, it's the first Indian spacecraft, I think, to hit Mars. They boast that their spacecraft, their space mission, cost $72 million versus ours, which was roughly $671 million for MAVEN. Is that because of the sophistication of the instrumentation?
The biggest difference is the different missions, the mission objective. Theirs is a smaller spacecraft with less instrumentation, a different goal, a different science goal, a different lifetime, and therefore they had to design it differently. Their requirements are different. It's the same way you wouldn't want to compare the cost of an economy car to a sports car or a pickup truck. They both serve some of the same functions of transportation, but they cost very different because they have very different goals and requirements.
Huh, interesting. Hey, quick question for you before we let you go. Describe the feeling in your stomach when you saw MAVEN successfully enter Mars orbit.
I'll be honest, I can't. I had every emotion going through my head from one extreme all the way to the other. I told my son that, and he said, denial. I bet you don't have denial. But every other emotion is going through me. It's undescribable. It's surreal.
That's
We're
so
speaking
great.
With Bruce Jakowski, MAVEN principal investigator from University of Colorado. If you're just joining us, they have just put together a really cool spacecraft. It's just hit the Mars orbit, and it begins a six-week commissioning phase with some very sophisticated instrumentation for looking at the atmosphere, trying to figure out where all the water went. Bruce, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Bruce.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, that's so cool. I love it. Good for him. Wow. I can't imagine like all of the cheers. You know, we see it on the TV, or, you know, when we see space-related movies, you see the cheers from, you know, the control tower.
We should go on a road trip, and we should go see a launch, and, you know.
It's a great idea. Road trip. A field trip. There we go. We always talk about it. We never do it. Let's do it, John. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael Harris and The End of Absence, a fascinating, actually rebroadcast interview with him. We liked it so much the first time.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, formerly Prudential Utah. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW and are excited to embark on the next era of Park City real estate under our new brand. More info at bhhsutah.com.
I'm John Wells.
I'm Peggy Ijams.
Join us Friday on The Morning Mix.
Grab your popcorn. We are going to be taking a look at great films coming our way in the next few months. We have musical guest Austin Wolf in the studio, and we're going to be learning all about Dynabout.
That's Friday in The Morning Mix at 9 a.m. Brought to you by Utah Olympic Park, Squatters, and Wasatch Brew Pub.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host John Wells. We were just speaking with Bruce Jakowski. He's the MAVEN principal investigator from the University of Colorado at Boulder, all about that Mars mission with MAVEN, that sweet little spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft. We never did say that, but I hope that was obvious or implied, I suppose.
You're really jazzed, aren't you?
I love that stuff.
Yeah.
In my next life, I'm going to come back as a
astrophysicist.
There we go. Thank you. See, I couldn't even come up with the word. Well, let's see. Soon enough, nobody will remember life before the internet. What does this unavoidable fact mean? Well, for future generations, it won't mean anything very obvious. They'll be so immersed in online life that questions about the internet's basic purpose or meaning even will vanish. But there are those of us who've lived with both with and without the crowded connectivity of online life. We have this rare opportunity. We can still recognize the difference between before and after and what it was like to just have these profound silences, absence, they call it. Well, our guest Michael Harris, in his new book, The End of Absence, argues that amid all these changes we're experiencing, really the most interesting one is that these future generations will have no more daydreaming silences, no burning solitudes, and no free time. I mean, pretty much we're there right now, at least when you carry a smartphone. Well, we spoke with Michael Harris back in August, and we liked it so much and found it so fascinating that we're going to rebroadcast that interview right now. Michael Harris, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Michael, wanted to ask you, what brought you to this journey to research our obsession with the digital life?
Well, I was working as a magazine editor, actually. This was a couple years ago. And like a lot of people who work in offices, I was just experiencing total digital overload. I had two computer screens open with dozens of windows open within them. I had my phone constantly pinging at me. And you know, then one day I actually got a text message from a guy who was worried because I hadn't texted him back in 5 minutes. And the text said, "Are you alive or what?" And I kind of read it as a literal question, "Are you alive?" And I looked up at these glowing rectangles and realized this isn't actually the life that I wanted for myself. This isn't how I want to spend my day. So I quit my job and started working on the book that became The End of Absence.
Yeah, and you say, not today, but certainly one day soon, nobody will remember life before the internet. And
yeah,
for future
exactly.
Generations...
I mean, I'm 34, mm-hmm. So I think of myself as like one of the last people through the gate, you know, like one of the last people that will remember life before the internet.
And it may mean something for us, as we know what was before and what was after, but future humans, they're going to be so immersed in a connected world than that pre-World Wide Web, a.k.a. the, you know, the Al Gore machine, it'll be boring history.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that, you know, for those future generations, the best thing that we can do is try and write down for them, whether it's in a book or whether it's in diaries or however, what was that way of thinking like that came before? Why was it important for us to have solitude and daydreaming? And we also need to actually get it into our school programs. We need to have critical studies and technology be part of the curriculum for high schools and even elementary schools, too.
Michael, I just want to say, you know, your book, when I picked it up, I first thought, you know, we read a lot of articles and books on the lack of, you know, real connection between people and how we only have texting and Twitter relationships with people. And your book was kind of refreshing because it was so different. It's beautifully written, and it gives us you don't talk so much about the loss as you talk about, you know, the reclaiming, and it's really well done. I really appreciate
that.
Thank
you. I mean, and I tried to make it a personal story too, because a lot of tech books are really all about big data and numbers, and that stuff is in there, and the the research is definitely in the book, but the point is that this is a personal thing that people today are actually living through, that that we can all actually associate with.
Mm, yeah. I'm wondering, you know, when you quit your job after you had this epiphany, what came to you? I mean, it is funny that we really can't imagine, although we say sometimes we go through an entire dinner leaving our phone in the car and just concentrating on conversation. And that's as though it's something, you know, it's some great feat we've accomplished. But, you know, what came up for you immediately following, you know, when you kind of came to this point in your life?
Well, you know, I took 30 days off from the internet and 30 days off from my cell phone. And I went through withdrawal symptoms. I was actually dreaming about text messages and emails at first because my brain was so hardwired toward that constant connection. And it really, it took, I would say, about 3 weeks before I started to relax a little bit.
Hmm.
But, you know, even then, abstinence is not the solution, I don't think. I think you can take a digital detox like that to wake yourself up, which is what, mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. I want to kind of jolt my system the way that you jolt your system when you, like, you say, I'm not going to eat sugar for 30 days or whatever.
Right.
But ultimately, you're going to go back into the real world, and it becomes about engineering a healthy media diet for yourself, so in the same way that you engineer a healthy food diet for yourself. And so it does have to be that balance between connection and disconnection.
There's something else going on in the way I observe this. I was working yesterday at the station. We're in a studio now we call the Fishbowl, and it's the Fishbowl because two of the walls are glass, and it looks out over the street and a lot of people out there. And it was almost like a zombie movie as you look at all the people walking up and down the street looking down at their phones. And there's something else besides being connected. I mean, obviously, we're sharing knowledge, we're collaborating, we're more able to compete. If you read Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat, there are a lot of positives, but there are people that are checking their email 4, 5, 6 times an hour as if you know, they're waiting to hear from Jesus or something, or, you know, there's something that important happening. And so
that was the stage I was at before I got into all this.
Mm-hmm.
It's an addiction, absolutely. And we're so desirous of that social connection. It's almost on an elemental level, I'd say, that we want ourselves to be acknowledged by others. And that's a totally understandable feeling to have. But, you know, I also want chocolate cake, and I'm going to make a decision not to eat it all the time because I have an idea of my own healthy future. So I think that's where we're getting to is people beginning to realize just because I want to check my email doesn't mean it's actually good for me.
Right. And I don't know if you've had this experience, but when I leave my phone in the car, and sometimes I leave it in there on purpose, and I get it later in the day, sometimes the next morning.
Yeah.
People get me on the phone and say, "Where are you?" "Oh, I'm right here."
Yeah.
"Well, why didn't you call me back?"
Angry said, that you. Yeah.
You know, you don't have to answer every phone call. You don't have to answer every call. Yeah. And
I think one of the things that you get when you disconnect is that it's increasingly rare. You get that moment of, or maybe a long period of time where you get to make decisions for yourself about your own ideas. You get to think for yourself without being jacked into the madding crowd, you know? It's that opportunity in our personal solitude, or even in the relative solitude of being with just one person over dinner, that you develop that rich interior life. I think that's ultimately what we end up missing when we lose absence.
Yes.
I wonder, Michael, you know, I think about back in the day when smoking was more fashionable, when more people did it, and then they would try to quit. You know, they needed that oral fixation or whatever it was, so they would eat gum and carrots and things like that. And now I almost feel like this thing that we have in our hands, we have created this need to constantly do something with our hands. And I've noticed myself, and I've been kind of ashamed when the realization kind of dawns on me that I just have picked up my phone, you know, 4 times in the last minute just to push the button to see. And I think, wow, I've got to stop that. You know, in your book, do you come up with like things to do instead, like the eating the carrots and the chewing the gum for a smoker?
You know, it's a really good question because I did, at one point while writing the book, in a chapter on attention span, I decided, okay, I'm going to read War and Peace in 2 weeks. So I forced myself to do that. And I did it. I did it. You know, not easy. But when I was reading it at home, sitting on the couch, while my laptop was, you know, glowing in the peripheral vision, tempting me, was torture. And so I did end up, I had to kind of trick my body, like those carrots trick smokers, I guess, into thinking that I had something else going on. So I would go on a walk with the book. I would go to like the neighborhood park and just walk around the park with War and Peace in my hand. And that seemed to help, actually. It took the edge off.
Michael, I enjoyed that chapter. And towards the end, when you're wrestling to get through the book, you get a phone call from a friend who invites you to a dinner party, or excuse me, a barbecue on his roof deck. And you say, no, I'm going to stay home tonight. I'm going to read a book. And the guy says, oh, God, you could have told me you had to wash your hair. What do you mean you're going to read a book?
Yeah.
What's that all about? And
we're so offended when people try and opt out, right? This is one of the insidious things about online technology is that you aren't allowed to leave. People will get upset with you if you disconnect. I mean, in that example you brought up, it wasn't about being offline. It was about just connecting at all. Like, you have to come be social with us. But this is another aspect of the same problem, which is, A, we're terrified of solitude, and B, we think when other people are not terrified of solitude, that there's something suspect going on, and that they mean to offend us somehow. And I think that's a serious misconception that we need to correct. We need to remember that if somebody doesn't text you back, it doesn't mean they hate you. It might mean that they've got a really interesting life right now, and they're not looking at the phone.
Yeah, so ha-ha.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, having your book in my hands over the last week, it's really made me reflect and notice, as John said, you know, he's looking out the live studio and sees these zombies, everyone's on their phone. It's made me recognize my own activity, and we only can speak for ourselves, but, you know, you're a writer, and I'm a writer, and I sit at my desk, and when I get stuck with creativity, when there's an impasse, you know what I do? I pick up my phone and I check it.
Yeah.
And I've noticed myself doing that. And not only does it further disable my creativity, it has started to make me think I'm going crazy. And I just think, you know, as you just developing an awareness. And so maybe, I don't know, that's just a comment, but maybe you can give us some ideas.
No, I have the exact same problem. When I'm writing, the moment I finish a paragraph, or I finish a thought, there's a microsecond of pause where I don't know what's going to happen next. And in that microsecond, I dive for the phone. And sometimes I do look at it, and other times I'm able to catch myself and pull back. Dive for the phone, or I dive for my email, because we're terrified of absence, right? That's why I wanted to write this book, because we're terrified of it, and we've forgotten why it might do something good for us. A lot of the time, we encounter that moment of boredom, and we think this must be bad for us. It's so bad, we have to fill it in. But, you know, we know that if we actually push through that boredom, we get to that's where the new ideas are. Mm. You don't have great new ideas through a comment feed or an algorithmic display on Yelp. You get great ideas from living in a moment of solitude and really encountering yourself and challenging your own ideas.
Mm. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Michael Harris, who has written a fascinating book, The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. In your chapter on authenticity, and I really got a kick out of this, you talk about the psychologist Jeffrey Miller when pondering why we haven't come across alien species as yet, and I'm reading from the book, decided that they were probably all addicted to video games and are thus brought to an extreme state of apathy, the exploratory opposite of the heroes in Star Trek who seek all of their time seeking new life and new civilizations. I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, and, you know, those aliens may be us. Right, they may be us in 20 years. We've certainly got awfully close to it. When you look at how much time is devoted to things that I don't think anybody would argue are actually substantial endeavors, most Tumblr feeds and most lolcats are not actually making the world a better place. They're not helping anybody in Rwanda. They're not advancing science or mathematics, and yet in our sort of our gross leisure, the average American teenager now spends, I think, 6 to 8 hours a day on screens, and this is a real tipping point for us. I'm 34 and. I'm part of the first generation in history to have more digital interactions than authentic face-to-face interactions, and we really do need to stop and ask ourselves, how does this change the way that I'm behaving? How does it change my potential as a human being?
Mm. You know, speaking of that interaction, just the same as I sit at my computer and when I have the inability to create more, I pick up my phone. I notice my teenage son who, you know, when I'm, as we all know, it's very difficult for a teenage boy to have a conversation, especially with his mom. But when I'm having a conversation with him, when he gets to that impasse, he picks up his phone and checks it right in the middle of the conversation.
Yeah.
And it makes me realize that social interaction, there's an excuse for it being impeded. You know, they have the excuse that, oh, I must check my phone. And even though there's been no indicator saying that he just got a text message or anything like that, he just goes to it because he doesn't know what else to do.
There's a glossary at the end of the book, and it's full of imaginary terms that I made up to try and describe the new world that we live in. And one of the terms is phone dodge, which is exactly what you're describing. It's when you have that slight awkwardness, and instead of addressing what's making you feel awkward, you dive into the phone.
Yeah. That is so great. And, you know, the same thing, phone dodge happens on, I'm a little bit behind on House of Cards. I've just recently, you know, found that I like it. Most everyone else has seen the whole series. But
love that show.
Zoe, the reporter, the young reporter, she has her phone in front of her with both hands on it all the time. I noticed this last night.
Yeah.
And you think that she's doing something meaningful, but she's, you know, maybe it is phone dodge that she's doing. That is so interesting. Yeah.
You know, it's on TV shows, you do see always the person who doesn't have a lot of power obsessed with their BlackBerry. You know, on West Wing, it's always like the three guys trailing behind the presidential candidate that are obsessively tittering on their BlackBerries. And I think that's a sign, possibly, of things to come, that those who get real power in the future maybe are going to have the luxury of absence. And if we're not careful, you know, the data mining and the constant tweeting is going to actually be something that digital serfs end up having to do. There'll be a kind of class system. Astra Taylor talks about this in her new book, The People's Platform, which is an excellent book. She talks about how we're entering a kind of stage of digital feudalism where we're being made to work on our BlackBerries, but we're not getting paid in the same way that like a serf would work a field in times gone by, and they were supposed to feel good that they actually had access to a farm, but nobody would actually pay them for their labor.
But the flip side of that would be the connectivity that we have with the bandwidth today, that somebody in abject poverty in India is able to now compete and go for a piece of the American pie because they're now able to connect to the internet.
But there is this debate about net neutrality, right? And we don't know whether that bandwidth is going to be accessible to all classes down the road.
Right.
It could be that the wealthy get one internet and the poor get another, which is something that we really do have to worry about.
Yeah, I would think it'd be in the best interest of any given country to want as much bandwidth in the hands of as many people in their country as possible. But, you know,
just the corporations
it ends
that
up being,
we'll see what
if
happens.
There's a limited amount of bandwidth available, then, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if the wealthy grabbed it for themselves.
Right. I wanted to ask you about this. There are a number of Gutenberg moments in your book, and in one piece, and this kills that in that particular chapter. You talk about Victor Hugo's book, Notre Dame of Paris, and how Archdeacon Claude Frollo sees his first printed book and just marvels at the production quality. And he's standing next to the Notre Dame and the cathedral, and he looks up and he says, "This book will kill that cathedral," and that it will kill the entire Catholic Church, because the printed book is a more nimbler conveyor of meaning than grand architectural gestures like the cathedral, which was stood as the handwriting of the human race. And so there was a lot of pushback, and there was a lot of concern way back then. And I guess every time that we've introduced technology, the same has happened.
Yeah, I mean, you can trace it back to Socrates. Socrates hated this new invention called writing. He thought this was going to ruin people's brains, and that the young would stop memorizing things because they could always write it down. And he was right. It did stop us from memorizing things to the same degree.
That's right.
Every step of the way, our communication technologies have brought us wonderful gifts and have shifted the way that we see the world and the way that we interact with the world. That's ultimately the message of the end of absence. It's not about technology good, technology bad. It's about technology is beautiful and dangerous, and we need to be smart about the way that we use it.
And that's what I liked about your book. It wasn't really a call to action with 10 easy steps. I mean, if there are 10 easy steps, it wouldn't be an easy problem you were solving, right? I mean, this is a big challenge for all of us. And so it's not a call to action. And you said you might even relinquish your life to the robot in the sky one day. So I forget exactly what you said.
I was saying, you know, I don't consider myself some sort of philosopher who has seen the light. I very much think of myself as living with these problems the same way everybody does, possibly more because I've been a journalist, I've been a magazine editor, and as such I was just inundated. It was part of my job to be really part of that that whirl of connectivity.
Before we let you go, Michael, I have to comment on my favorite made-up term or in your glossary, and that's going Walden.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Obviously, Walden
going
pond.
Walden, going Walden is just the kind of fanciful idea of following in Thoreau's footsteps and just, like, unplugging, walking out into the woods, and having that fantasy of disconnection, which we can do for a short while, but then, just like Thoreau, we always have to come back.
Yeah. Okay, on Saturday night, I've got an evening out on the town planned, and I'm going Walden. There's my good commitment. One. You got that?
I'm going to check in with her. I don't believe it. We'll have to see.
It is interesting, I will say, because what keeps me from going Walden oftentimes is probably an excuse, but it's a viable excuse, and that's that I always want to be available for my children in case they're somewhere and they need me or that sort of thing. I mean,
yeah,
that's
right.
And here's the challenge, I think, on that is that, like for an example, I don't engage in Facebook just because I just don't have time for that. But I'm a technology guy, and I carry my phone because my children live in other parts of the country, and I want to have that in case they ever need to get in touch with me. So I'm not on Facebook, but now someone sends me a distribution text. There's 20 people on it. Do you want to come to this barbecue? Someone replies to the entire distribution. I'll bring coleslaw. Another person replies, and then my phone beeps again.
That's the worst.
Can't make it, but I love coleslaw. And another person replies and says, I'll be there. I'm wearing a blue shirt, and tomorrow I'm wearing a yellow one. I mean, who cares? So what do we do? Can I send a text back to everybody in the distribution and use some colorful language and just get it over with? Or, what should I do?
Well, we used to do that at the magazine when I was working there. You'd get caught in these reply all tornadoes, right, where everyone's reply alling. And you end up finding out exactly what kind of pine nuts Julie wants to use in her coleslaw. And you really don't need the distraction. And there would always be actually this girl called Perrin over in the art department who would do one final reply all to inform everybody to stop using reply all. There would be that kind of, the warden would come in and she would smack down. Is there a way out of that? Not really if you're in a corporate environment, right? Because part of the deal is to be plugged in.
Yeah,
it's a luxury when you unplug, and I was totally aware of that when I left my job and I took my month off from the internet. That was a real luxury, but vacations are a luxury, and we do all get vacations, and you'd be surprised how little the world falls apart when you don't take your phone with you on a run, or you don't check the internet over the weekend.
Well, we could talk to you all morning, but we're running out of time, and we want to thank you, Michael Harris, who has written a fascinating book, The End of Absence: Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with some cool stories and some cool products after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, lrw-law.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Want to thank our guest today. We had Michael Harris there with The End of Absence. Very interesting. Also, Bruce Jacoski. He's the chief investigator on the MAVEN, the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. Mm. They were great.
Fantastic. And the guy had a lot of enthusiasm. He's very excited.
Mm-hmm. Don't blame him for that.
Well, it's today's cool story. We could actually do 10 cool stories. We should probably do a show sometime just on cool stories. But before the cool stories, we have a couple of cool products. First product is Backtrack Vio. It's the size of a keychain. The Vio is one of the smallest breathalyzers available. It measures blood alcohol content and even estimates when the level will drop low enough to drive safely. $50.
Yeah, I like that. Now, I didn't actually know these existed, I have to admit, but if you look it up, keychain breathalyzer, you find all kinds of them. I haven't found reviews to really uncover how well these work and to what degree of precision, because you'd hate to trust one of those while you're at the bar and then drive home and,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, but interesting and worthy for sure.
The next one's a collaboration. between the American Red Cross and Eaton Corporation. They've come up with a pretty cool flashlight. It's an emergency light that can run for 72 hours without any batteries at all. And all you need to do, because they put some chemicals in it, is just put a few drops of water into it to activate it. Again, it'll run for 72 hours, and it's $10.
Yeah, every good survivalist must have one of these. And my question that you have to get back to me on, John, is how a couple of drops of water can activate a battery.
Well, they have dry photovoltaic cells that require certain acids, and if they dry the acid and they put that in there, then the water, if it activates the acid, then the photovoltaic stuff happens.
Oh, you already had the answer.
Well, I don't know if I have the answer. That was just basically taking a shot at it. I don't really know how they developed
this,
but
for
$10, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
So let me introduce the first cool story. We have had a number of cool stories on Google Glass. And here's a new app for Google Glass. It detects people's emotions. And if I can just describe, I'm looking at a picture of a young woman that someone with Google Glass on is looking at, and it focuses on her face. And the Google Glass will guess her age, the person's gender, and then say if she's angry,
happy,
sad,
surprised, shocked.
We work well together. We do.
I'm actually a little shocked that this exists. However, before you start saying when will it end, you know, any number of things that takes away our own ability to ascertain someone's emotion. I mean,
I'm jaded.
Yeah, I know you're jaded. I can't imagine leaving intuition up to something else like a Google Glass. However, think about it in this way. This is sort of has been developed and designed for those who have autism. And as we know, those with autism have an inability to read emotion. They can't read things like sarcasm or joking or things like that. So this would be very useful. So it's not meant to uncover your spouse's indiscretions, like, oh yeah, I'm going over to Fred's for a football game.
Right.
Oh no, where are you really going? That look on your face, Google Glass is telling me it's a big lie.
Oh yeah, you know, I wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about the brain dead guys that are in relationships and they can't tell if their girlfriend or spouse is angry or happy.
Oh
or
right, because we say no,
surprised.
That's okay, dear.
Oh, that's okay. So, kind of a cool application. We'll see what happens. Some of the stuff is a little nutty, but, you know, I guess they're trying to make money.
That's right. The possibilities are endless. What else do we have?
Well, there's a new study that says that many video games designed to entertain, and I'm talking specifically right now about Portal 2. Many of these video games designed to entertain can have positive effects on brain cognition. While not all commercial products sold improves cognition as they advertise. Specifically, we're looking at a study, Lynn and I, where Luminosity, which was designed to improve cognition, does not do as good a job as people that have been tested who play Portal 2, a video game.
That's pretty interesting. A small control group, as they say. But, you know, I've heard things like Luminosity get bashed a few times. You know what I've also heard is listening to public radio makes you smarter, improves your cognition well beyond what Luminosity can do. And learning a second language will do the same. So there you have it.
Well, I know our show will help you sleep.
No. And I would argue for public radio and learning a foreign language before I would argue for playing video games, but that's just me.
I like what this one doctor said, though. He said, if entertainment games actually do a better job than games designed for neuroplasticity, what that suggests is that we are clearly missing something important about neuroplasticity. So
Interesting. You're listening to KPCW in Park City. Thanks to San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Property, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT.